This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in today's program, we follow up on that major oil pipeline disruption in Arkansas and what it portends for the potential construction of the Keystone XL pipeline that would span the United States from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. Also today, we'll be speaking with Norman Solomon of Roots Action about a new petition that is gaining momentum around the world to strip President Barack Obama of his Nobel Peace Prize and to award one to whistleblower Bradley Manning of the WikiLeaks releases. All that and more. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and today we follow up on the story of the oil breach in a pipeline in Arkansas, just 20 miles north of Little Rock, in which the Exxon-operated Pegasus pipeline released what may be somewhere between 100 and 200,000 gallons of heavy crude from the Canadian tar sands, particularly dangerous for the tenure and stability of pipelines because of its granulated content, as well as its bitumen component, which apparently is more corrosive on metal pipes than many other forms of gas. And we're very pleased to have with us Kate Hudson. She is the Watershed Program Director of the environmental organization Riverkeeper, and welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow, Kate.
Thank you very much.
Have you been following the Arkansas disaster?
I have been, and I am struck by how their initial estimate of 10,000 barrels spilled has increased exponentially.
The release took place in a residential neighborhood. At first, it was reported that 24 households were being evacuated, but now we are hearing stories that it's as many as 40 or perhaps more at this point in time, that there are noxious or toxic fumes that are still in the neighborhood, that there was the potential danger of the oil going into a nearby lake and water tables and rivers nearby. And what is the danger that accompanies this kind of an oil release?
Well, I think that we have seen releases in more wilderness areas, for instance, into some very iconic rivers and obviously into the Gulf of Mexico. And we're very familiar with the impact that that has on biota and fisheries and other kinds of really important economic activity. But I don't think that we've seen that many oil releases in residential neighborhoods. And I think what was incredibly striking was the visual footage of a river of oil running down a street in a residential subdivision. One of the residents being quoted, am I supposed to send my daughter out there to play?
Also striking are the images of ducks that are already encrusted or caked or covered in oil. And the prospect that this particular type of, I believe it's called dilbit oil, has a very heavy or large specific gravity, which means that its presence in waterways may not be immediately obvious because it would tend to seep to the bottom. That, in addition to the corrosiveness of bismuth, of bitumen, rather. So, is this just a harbinger of the infrastructure of oil pipelines that could strike anywhere across the country?
I think it's a harbinger of pipelines generally. I mean, I certainly think we should be concerned about ruptures in oil pipelines, but as we have seen, there are also ruptures, deadly ruptures, of gas pipelines. And, you know, this is a particular concern given our advocacy around the whole issue of hydrofracking. But there is currently about 2.5 million miles of gas pipeline in this country. I actually don't have the figure on oil pipelines, that was built before 1970. And most of the danger of ruptures with the pipelines is at least with this age pipeline, is that they've lost 70% of their thickness. But even with new pipelines, what we're seeing is that nobody's minding the store. Neither federal nor state agencies really set you know, have regulations that govern how these pipelines are built and how they are operated, and they are not requiring safety equipment that is available. For instance, safety equipment that indicate that is leak detection and automatic shutoff valves is available to be installed. It's not required to be installed, and companies don't because it's too expensive.
The Pegasus pipeline was built in the 1940s, and this brings us to the major question before us today, the potential construction now of a new north-to-south national pipeline carrying more tar sands oil from Canada into the United States from the Canadian border all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And there are wranglings in Nebraska and in particular in New York State as to whether or not that pipeline should be built. And Congress now has moved in on it as well, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, with there being initiatives to vote a law that would make the construction of the pipeline mandatory. So what is the status of the Keystone XL pipeline today?
I know that there was there were some congressmen that were intending to introduce that legislation. I did not have the impression that there was any chance that it would go anywhere. Mm-hmm. The decision on this pipeline remains with the president. You know, there are groups that are obviously trying very hard to influence his decision-making with respect to this. I think that a cautionary tale of the Pegasus pipeline and the spill that we're having right now, the Pegasus pipeline transports 90,000 barrels of oil per day. The Keystone would carry 830,000 barrels per day. So think about, you know, what a spill with a rupture in that pipeline would be. And that's only one of the reasons. Obviously, there is a whole host of environmental reasons, not the least of which, and I don't know whether this is something that you saw, but the New York Times printed an op-ed from an individual who lives in Ontario, Canada, on March 31st, and basically the message of the op-ed was, Mr. Obama, please save Canada from itself. And deny the permit to build this pipeline.
Because the pipeline would cross international borders, there was a requirement that the State Department issue an analysis of the possible construction of XL. And if I'm not mistaken, the gist of the State Department study was, well, yes, there are some risks, but it is the best of all possible plans. Are you familiar with that report?
I'm familiar with that report, and I'm also familiar with the fact that the people that prepared the report had ties to industry. And, in fact, their names and their, obviously, their ties to industry were removed from the report itself. And it was only because some individuals dug up the information that it was later made public. And so this really calls into question the reliability of the report, and hopefully the executive will think twice before basing their decision on it.
Is it possible to read the tea leaves of the White House and President Obama in regard to whether he is inclined or disinclined to have this pipeline built?
I really am not in a position to be able to do that. I'm probably in the same position as everybody else who listened to the State of the Union address and the all of the above energy strategy that this White House has put forward. Every indication that we have is that it's still a very live possibility, and we're very concerned about it.
There was much consternation and debate in the state of Nebraska, which would be one of the target areas of this pipeline. What kind of response has there been from various localities along the north-south route of it?
I think that, and I don't know specifically, but what I know to be the case is that there are a number of states for whom the particular path of the pipeline presented problems because it went through sensitive areas within the state. And my impression is that Keystone is attempting to sort of divide and conquer and win some of those states over by altering the route. Whether or not they're being successful in doing that, I don't know.
What kind of organizations or industrial groups are involved in affecting localities' decisions about approval? What kind of arm twisting or incentives are being played out here?
That's a good question, and I actually don't know on a state-by-state basis. I assume that environmental groups are very strongly advocating to protect sensitive areas, and I don't know that there is a state-by-state industrial or gas industry, I mean oil and gas industry lobbying campaign on that level. I think that lobbying is probably going on in Washington.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. Our guest is Kate Hudson, the Watershed Program Director of the environmental organization Riverkeeper. What is the talk that you hear in Albany about the potential unleashing of hydrofracking in New York State?
Well, I mean, I think that we have been very encouraged in recent weeks, Riverkeeper and our partners that have been working on this issue so hard for the last 3-4 years. We are definitely hearing a governor and an environmental agency that and a health department that seems more focused on the idea that they should understand the potential health impacts of bringing hydrofracking into New York before making its decision on whether or not to do so. We still haven't had the final word from the health department. We're waiting for the health department to report back to DEC. But the indications are good that finally the health of New York citizens has become the focus of this decision, and we are hoping that the decision that will be made is we don't have enough information yet. The studies are just starting to be done. We should wait until that information comes in before making a decision.
Kate, does the potential for there being hydrofracking in New York State mean that there would be new or additional pipelines for the gas that would be extracted, and would those pipelines affect major metropolitan centers like New York City?
The answer to that is there are pipelines that are already affecting major metropolitan areas, and that is because pipelines are being constructed to carry frack gas from Pennsylvania into the New York market. And one of the things that is very, very concerning about the approval process for pipelines, whether it be the state or the federal government approving them, and all the interstate pipelines are approved by the federal government, is that they both exert the power of eminent domain, which means that they can tell a landowner who is unwilling, we're going to put a pipeline across your property. We'll pay you something, but you don't get to say no. And this taking of private property, the authority to do that so that pipelines can be run, is extremely disruptive of communities and individuals and the value of their property. And we will only see more of it if hydrofracking comes to New York.
What are the novel hazards of hydrofracking that appears to be the latest clarion call for the oil industry?
The hazards of hydrofracking are actually the hazards of extracting shale gas, methane, from tight shale plays. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the Marcellus Shale. And this is a new extreme energy extraction process that has only been developed in the last 7 to 8 years, and it's only come to the Northeast in the last 5 years, and it involves, it's an industrial activity. It's an industrial activity that is going on in other states, in people's backyards, next to their children's schools, and it is converting beautiful bucolic farmland into industrial wasteland. And this is being allowed to go on in state parks, and all kinds of, and federal parks, federal Bureau of Land Management land, and the visual images, if you were to go online and look at some of these images, is absolutely striking. But in terms of the concerns from a health perspective, there are concerns both from a water contamination perspective, but I think more and more we're beginning to focus on the concerns related to air pollution and the impacts that that is having on communities that are, you know, in the middle of drilling rigs or drilling rigs in the middle of their communities.
The injection of highly pressurized fluids in order to break up the shale and extract the gases and fluids, is that considered a risk to water tables, and have there been any indications of that happening in anywhere?
Well, there is obviously a tremendous amount of debate about what, yes, there is a risk. How great that risk is debated extensively, and part of the reason why this has not been a very productive debate is because the industry has been so unwilling to share information. They will not share what it is, what chemicals they're using. When there are impacts on people's water, there are court settlements and the records get sealed, and the people involved who have to agree to these settlements in order to be able to get drinking water are not allowed to talk to the press or talk to government agencies. And so we have an extreme lack of information. What we do know is that in Pennsylvania, hydrofracking has caused methane, drinking water in communities, in wells, to be contaminated with methane itself, which makes the well water explosive, and it can be lit on fire, and it can't be used. Out west, we've seen some evidence that the areas of adjacent to areas that are being drilled in Wyoming and Colorado have been the drinking water itself, the aquifers, are contaminated with some of the chemicals associated with drilling. But the risks to water are not just those that would go on underground where the hydrofracking is going on. There is a tremendous risk of water contamination as a result of what's going on the surface. The handling of the chemicals, the handling of the millions of gallons of wastewater that is generated by this activity, the improper disposal, the running it through treatment plants that aren't equipped to be able to handle it, and then discharging the partially treated waste into rivers that are used as a source for drinking water, which is what happened in Pennsylvania. And so there are a whole host. The impacts on farm stock from leaks from lagoons that contain this wastewater, which have killed off and or caused birth defects in cattle and pigs. All of this is the canary in the coal mine for New York.
Kate Hudson, I've been monitoring some petrochemical industry insider talk, and many analysts in the oil and gas industry are suggesting that the fracking process of producing gas and oil may not be anywhere near as economically feasible as first promised. Do you consider the economic side in your analysis?
Well, we absolutely do consider the economic side from the perspective of the argument that's being put forward by the industry and some governments that how can we possibly turn away from this economic boon that's going to be offered by hydrofracking. And there are a number of different reasons why. First of all, the jobs that are supposedly going to come along with the activity have been shown to be the typical extractive industry boom and bust syndrome, so that when things are being drilled, there are some people that come into town and they buy more breakfast and stay in the motel and et cetera. And then once the drilling is completed, they're gone. And that short boom is gone. But there is also the consideration that if, in fact, because the price of gas is so low and the cost of drilling is so high, that there is pressure on the bottom line of these companies, they are going to do everything they can to cut corners and not potentially have environmental protections in place that would cost them more money, but would be, you know, required or at least hoped for in terms of protecting communities and the environment. And so the pressure is on them to cut corners, and the result can only be a devastation for health and communities and the environment.
Kate Hudson, I want to thank you so much for a thorough analysis of both the issue of hydrofracking and of precarious pipelines, whether Pegasus or elsewhere throughout the country. How may our listeners learn more about your work?
I would encourage them to visit us at riverkeeper.org. Our website has a lot of information about these issues, and also if you connect with us, we will send out information about actions that you could take if you feel strongly about this issue or other issues that we are actively engaged on.
Well, thank you once again, Kate Hudson of Riverkeeper. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll be back with more right after this.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's a red on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil bars winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling. And even now I can remember, 'cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking through my dreams. Burn on, big river, burn on. Burn on, big river, burn on. Now the Lord can make you tumble, the Lord can make you turn, the Lord can make you overflow, but the Lord can make you burn. Burn on, big river, burn on. Burn on, big river, burn on.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we're now joined live by Norman Solomon, a co-founder of the national or perhaps international organization called Roots Action. And Norman, I understand that you're involved in a breathtaking campaign in regard to peace and the Nobel Prize. And I understand that you would take it from one and give it to another. In particular, President Barack Obama is being challenged on his merit for being a Nobel laureate as a recipient of the Peace Prize. Can you welcome back to the 5 O'Clock Shadow. Tell us what you're doing.
Thanks, Robert. Yeah, I'm very pleased the way this is going. RootsAction.org launched this morning an international campaign to call upon the Norwegian Nobel Committee to revoke the Nobel Peace Prize for President Obama. And in the last hours, more than 7,000 people have signed the petition. I certainly hope that listeners to 5 O'Clock Shadow on BAI will add their names and, if you'd like, their comments, because we're delivering both names and commentaries to the Nobel Committee. And you can do that by going to rootsaction.org. I think that in these times, it's so important to challenge these huge exercises in Orwellian doublespeak. And certainly right alongside War is Peace, we have Nobel Peace Prize winner President Obama.
What are the objections to his merit for receiving the Peace Prize?
Well, they're manifold. In at least half a dozen countries, President Obama has ordered drone and cruise and other military attacks on innocent civilians and others without the governments being at war. He, after receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, continued to escalate war in Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, after taking office in January of 2009, President Obama proceeded to triple the number of U.S. uniformed troops on the ground in Afghanistan, as well as sending in tens of thousands more ununiformed military contractors. And even now, you know, as we speak, Robert, there are substantially more U.S. troops in Afghanistan than when the president took office. And I think it's very troubling when we have this very tragic, oxymoronic situation where that kind of war effort, which has spread to break down any sense of boundaries in terms of geographical divisions or the calendar, so that essentially much of the world is the shooting ground for the Pentagon, and just as once a week the president signs off on a kill list, he also has normalized as a bipartisan now administrative policy after Bush, now him, to say that perpetual war is, well, perpetual.
Drones, is that a part of the basis for the petition?
Well, certainly. This idea that the president across international borders, just on his own say-so, with contempt for international law, can order what's been hundreds of drone strikes. You know, as one of the signers of the petition today said, you don't get to be a Nobel Peace Prize winner, or you shouldn't get to be one, just because you're not George W. Bush. And the fact is that manyfold increase has taken place of the use of drone attacks by this president than the previous one. So it gets down to, if you're going to tell other people that they shouldn't use violence to achieve their political ends, how in the world can this president claim to be a valid recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize when, in fact, he would be outraged if any other country attempted to do to the United States what the U.S. is doing to so many other countries and communities around the world. And, you know, as I've sat here this afternoon, every time I go to rootsaction.org, I see more and more, not only signers, but very cogent and moving comments, sometimes three words, sometimes 100, from people who are just morally affronted that this guy would have the Peace Prize.
Norman Solomon, President Obama has arithmetically escalated the number of troops in Afghanistan and geometrically increased the usage of drones for remote control killings, as well as what intelligence specialists and others like Daniel Ellsberg say has created a much more vigorous war or countermeasures against whistleblowers. And if I'm not mistaken, another part of this initiative is to also indicate to the Nobel Committee that the recipient this year should be WikiLeaks whistleblower Private Bradley Manning. What is happening on that front?
Yes, last week we launched a parallel campaign at rootsaction.org to urge the Nobel Committee to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Bradley Manning. We've been overwhelmed with now more than 35,000 signatures from around the United States as well as elsewhere in the world. And certainly the permanent warfare state, what Dr. King called the madness of militarism, is now being manifested under this presidency in terms of including the assault on civil liberties, the habeas corpus being thrown under the bus, the assault on privacy, massive surveillance, and do we need to destroy our liberties in order to ostensibly save them? This is the real challenge we have, and I think at rootsaction.org we're so thrilled to be part of this growing effort to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Bradley Manning, who, as the premier anti-war whistleblower of this century, certainly deserves it as he sits in prison, and to take it away from President Obama, who sadly and clearly does not deserve it.
Well, Norman Solomon, I want to thank you for making us aware of this snowballing movement to rectify the historical revisionism of the Nobel Committee in terms of its award to one of the most war-making presidents in contemporary times. And tell us once more how people can find out more and be in touch.
Yes, people can find out about the petition, sign up, and share it with others by going on the web, rootsaction.org.
Well, thank you. Norman Solomon will be following this development, and good luck with the campaign.
Thank you, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we follow up the discussion about the Nobel Peace Prize with this this recollection of what actually happened both in 1964 with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and in 2009 when President Barack Obama, as his first major policy act, tripled the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. President George Bush before him only sent in 35,000. President Obama sent in 70,000 troops into Afghanistan. So we consider these issues and the procedures and ceremonies of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee and the acceptance by laureates, along with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Barack Obama, and Chris Wells, organizer of the International Peace March.
Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen.
I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace.
At a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States
are engaged in a creative battle
to end the long night of racial injustice,
I accept this award
on behalf of the civil rights movement, which is moving with determination
and a majestic scorn for risk and danger, to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice.
I'm mindful
that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama,
our children crying out for brotherhood were answered with
fire hoses,
snarling dogs,
and even death.
I'm mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people
seeking to secure the right to vote
were brutalized and murdered.
And only yesterday, more than 40 houses of worship in the state of Mississippi alone were bombed or burned because they offered a sanctuary
to those who would not accept segregation.
I'm mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder.
Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle.
To a movement which has not yet won the very peace and brotherhood, which is the essence of the Nobel Prize.
After contemplation, I conclude that this award which I receive on behalf of that movement is profound recognition
that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time.
The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression.
Civilization and violence
are antithetical concepts.
Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity,
but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation.
Sooner or later, all the people of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace
and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy
into a creative psalm of brotherhood.
If this is to be achieved,
man must evolve for all human conflict
a method which rejects revenge,
aggression, and retaliation.
The foundation of such a method is love.
the tortuous road which has led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo bears witness to this truth.
This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling
to find a new sense of dignity.
This same road has opened for all Americans a new era of progress and hope.
It has led to a new civil rights bill, and it will, I am convinced,
be widened and lengthened into a superhighway of justice.
As Negro and white men in increasing numbers
create alliances to overcome their common problems, I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America.
And an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history.
I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him.
This is why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. I believe that even amid today's mortar bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. Yet when years have rolled past, and when the blazing light of truth is focused on this marvelous age in which we live, men and women will know, and children will be taught, that we have a finer land, a better people, a more noble civilization, because these humble children of God were willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. I think Alfred Nobel would know what I mean when I say I accept this award in the spirit of a curator of some precious heirloom which he holds in trust for its true owners. All those to whom truth is beauty, and beauty truth, and in whose eyes the beauty of genuine brotherhood and peace is more precious than diamonds or silver or gold. Thank you.
As Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is the epicenter of violent extremism practiced by Al-Qaeda. It is from here that we were attacked on 9/11, and it is from here that new attacks are being plotted as I speak. This is no idle danger, no hypothetical threat, and this danger will only grow if the region slides backwards and Al-Qaeda can operate with impunity. The people and governments of both Afghanistan and Pakistan are in danger, and the stakes are even higher within a nuclear-armed Pakistan, because we know that Al-Qaeda and other extremists seek nuclear weapons, and we have every reason to believe that they would use them. These facts compel us to act along with our friends and allies. Our overarching goal remains the same: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we must deny Al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future. We will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010, the fastest possible pace, so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers.
These military advisors keep saying, send us more troops, and that if you just do that, that we're about to turn the corner, that there's light at the end of the tunnel. I just have a hard time swallowing that. Obama has already ordered 21,000 more troops to Afghanistan in March, so this will be the second escalation since he's taken office. So the military people keep giving this advice, and they did exactly the same thing in Vietnam. And the president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, complied with it and said, well, they must know what they're talking about. And in the end, they really didn't. There has to be a will and a viability for domestic leadership, and it can't rely so heavily on outside forces. And basically, we can't win the war for the current government of Afghanistan, whether it's NATO or American troops. And yet, the truth is that things are going steadily in the wrong direction. And I think at some point we have to really change strategy. We are taking essentially a militaristic approach. We are not having a real any significant humanitarian surge. I mean, at this point, only 1,000 additional humanitarian workers have been ordered compared to now with tonight's announcement. It'll be something like 55,000 to 60,000 additional troops will have been ordered under President Obama. This newest escalation really moves us toward another 10 years of involvement, which basically makes it a two-decade war at a minimum. And I don't realistically see any good end point to get out even after 20 years. So the American people really don't support this. And I think now is the time to say no. The deeper we get in, the more of a quagmire and quicksand we're in. And it gets harder and harder. We lose more and more troops, more and more innocent Afghanis get killed. And we just drive more and more people into the arms of the Taliban and of Al-Qaeda, ultimately. So I think this is a counterproductive strategy, and I think the president has really failed us. You know, he's about to get the Nobel Peace Prize in less than a week. How can you be honoring a president whose basic approach is a militaristic approach? War is really not the answer. And I think anybody who gets the Nobel Peace Prize had better understand that.
And citizens of the world, I receive this honor with deep gratitude and great humility. And yet I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the considerable controversy that your generous decision has generated. In part, this is because I am at the beginning and not the end of my labors on the world stage. Compared to some of the giants of history who have received this prize, Schweitzer and King, Marshall and Mandela, my accomplishments are slight. But perhaps the most profound issue surrounding my receipt of this prize is the fact that I am the Commander-in-Chief of a military, of a nation, in the midst of two wars. One of these wars is winding down. The other is a conflict that America did not seek, one in which we are joined by 42 other countries, including Norway, in an effort to defend ourselves and all nations from further attacks. Still, we are at war. I'm responsible for the deployment of thousands of young Americans to battle in a distant land. And some will kill, and some will be killed. In today's wars, many more civilians are killed than soldiers. The seeds of future conflict are sown. Economies are wrecked, civil societies torn asunder, refugees amassed, children scarred. I do not bring with me today a definitive solution to the problems of war. Furthermore, America, in fact, no nation, can insist that others follow the rules of the road if we refuse to follow them ourselves. For when we don't, our actions appear arbitrary and undercut the legitimacy of future interventions, no matter how justified. And this becomes particularly important when the purpose of military action extends beyond self-defense or defense of one nation against an aggressor. More and more, we all confront difficult questions about how to prevent the slaughter of civilians by their own government, or to stop a civil war whose violence and suffering can engulf an entire region. I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds, as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war. Inaction tears at our conscience and can lead to more costly intervention later. And that's why all responsible nations must embrace the role that militaries with a clear mandate can play to keep the peace.
There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty. Against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom, there has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. And it's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silenced. The truth must be told. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. Tomorrow may be too late, and don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, "You are too arrogant." I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together, and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last." With this faith, men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
We have all seen them standing amidst the surprise. Sometimes a man smiles. I often wonder, you can tell he's a thinker by the faraway look in his eyes. The faraway look in his eyes. A pity for his thoughts could make him richer. Could see what other eyes could not. What is the power of an Ammonian, but not mere power, but magnetism?
And magnetism
is more intelligent than force. Magnetism is more intelligent than
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. We welcome your comments, suggestions, leaks, and queries with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Hey, 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 hey